Thanks for downloading a 3CR podcast. 3CR is an independent community radio station based in Melbourne, Australia. We need your financial support to keep going. Go to www.3cr.org.au for more information and to donate online. Now stay tuned for your 3CR podcast.
But you also had people that were very fine people.
Very fine people.
On both sides.
And the aliens would mind meld and give them the technology. They're bad aliens. So are you surprised the Nazis were influenced by demons?
No, if demons are real, I would definitely think they'd be on the side of the Nazis.
Yeah.
McDonald's is connected to the Clintons. They chop up the bodies and put them into the sausage and hamburgers. People are being cannibalized. Look it up.
And I'm watching CNN talk about this as violent white nationalist protests. We have done everything in our power to keep this peaceful, you know?
It's Pepe's become kind of a symbol.
Good afternoon, gentle listeners. You're listening to Yeah Nah Passeran, a show about fascism and its gravediggers. I'm Cam Smith.
I'm Andy Fleming.
And this week we are joined by Ariel Bogle and Cam Wilson, the authors of Conspiracy Nation, out now through Ultimo Press. Ariel, Cam, thanks for joining us.
Great to be here.
Thanks to be back. Wait, what? I said thanks to be back. Sorry. Not a good start.
I guess just to begin with, I was just scrolling through TikTok and the very first video I was served was a woman. She says she's a teacher and she walked into her principal's office and he had like a dog bed on the floor and the dog bowl, and so she said it must be for the furries. I thought that's inauspicious video to watch just before doing this interview. It could just be that he has a dog. Could you tell us a little bit about Conspiracy Nation? What is the book and why did you write it?
Well, we started talking about this book at the beginning of 2023. I think both of us had been covering during the pandemic some of the false claims about the virus that were spreading, some of the groups that were coming together to protest the lockdowns, you know, what we've now called the anti-lockdown movement or the freedom movement, some of the key figures and gurus who were selling, you know, bizarre health plans or crowdfunding to rave like quixotic challenges at the High Court to vaccine mandates, all this activity. And it seemed like a good time to pause and look back at what had happened, but also to cast a wider view, because I think like in the media and in the, you know, public commentary, we think of conspiracy theories as something coming out of America being imported into Australia, but we didn't really think that was quite right. And so this book was a chance for us to look more closely at Australia's own homegrown conspiracy theory culture, where it emerges from, what it kind of questions about our national character, our national stories, and look a bit more at the effects it's having on a personal and a community level.
Yeah, and Cam, like that video you saw, conspiracy theories really are everywhere. And one of the big things that people generally seem to say is that they think that conspiracy theories are a bigger part of their lives and bigger part of public life. Many people assume that more people believe in them. Actually, the evidence doesn't necessarily say that's true, but it's very hard to deny that they are not something that seems a lot more present in our lives. And like when you see a TikTok video of someone fearing that their school secretly has, is secretly turning their kids into furries, that is, of course, something that sounds ridiculous and is ridiculous, you know, that's not something that's really happening. But it is also quite revealing. These things that people fear, the things that they think are important and need to be protected, they all tell us something about, you know, what we are, what we value as Australians. And so our book was trying to look at, well, what do these actually tell us about? Let's look at them. Let's look at the conspiracy theories that are big in Australia, that have been started in Australia, and understand what they tell us about what it means to be Australian.
One of the events that you look at in the book is the Port Arthur massacre and the conspiracy theories that emerged from that. You look at it as being this foundational conspiracy myth in the Australian conspiracy landscape. Could you tell us a little bit about what the conspiracy theory is around Port Arthur, and if it's not obvious, and how it has resonated through the years?
Yeah, listeners of the show will probably be familiar, but so the Port Arthur massacre happened in 1996 when Mun Bryant opened fire at a cafe in Tasmania and killed a whole bunch of people. And the conspiracy theories that surround that are around this idea that either Bryant didn't do it and that he was set up for it, and they call that a false flag operation, or as well this other idea that maybe he did do it, but he was brainwashed or somehow tricked into doing it. And a lot of these kind of linked back to this idea that as a result of the Port Arthur massacre, we saw this, you know, a rare thing in politics where we saw a drastic action on a topic, and Australia really cracked down and instituted much stricter gun laws. We wrote about it in the book because while, you know, conspiracy theories have always been around and long precede the internet, we were able to figure out that conspiracy theories around this event really took off once the internet started to become a big part of our lives. And that goes this idea that we're not sure that necessarily more people have conspiratorial thinking, are prone to thinking that there are secret plots or whatever everywhere, but the internet has allowed, in a way never before, for people to come together to interact with each other and to organize, and that includes conspiracy theorists as well. And so in this way, we saw that the conspiracy theory around Port Arthur, you know, this idea that either it was set up or wasn't true, it suddenly went from maybe a few people muttering to, like you mentioned, Cam, a foundational belief where it's one of like almost like the original sins of the Australian government, according to like many conspiracy theorists who believe it's a big example of them taking action against the public, deceiving the public in order to disarm the public with ultimately some goal of a greater, more evil plan.
So they've taken our guns, but will they ever take our memes?
Never.
Did you find anything distinctive or distinctively Australian to the various ideas you examined in the book? Did they have an Australian flavour as opposed to, I guess, the US model?
It's a great question. And one I really got struck by was the Australian roots of pseudo-law. You know, people might be more familiar with the term sovereign citizen. But people, you know, because sovereign citizen is such a distinctly US term, prefer the pseudo-law genre, gives that overarching bucket in which to put a whole range of beliefs that end up at the same place around the illegitimacy of government or the inapplicability of laws to individuals. And yes, there is a strong history of that in the United States, but the history of that here precedes some of those really key moments, the Posse Comitatus in the American South in the 80s and 90s. We already had our own stuff up and running by that time. And often in Australia, it really centres around distinct historical moments. So whether it was the Federation of Australia or when we legally extricated ourselves from the UK legal system, where you could no longer appeal back to the UK, the end of the line, I guess, was the High Court within Australia. These are all key moments that the history of pseudo-law in Australia sort of points to, as the moment when the Australian government became illegitimate, became a corporation, or some plot was enacted to put Australians under the thumb of some evil plot. So it was interesting to look at that and reclaim pseudo-law for Australians in a perverse way and look at that history, because we also have this really distinct history of micronations where people have a plot of land, declare that it has seceded or was never part of the federal colony of Australia. And I think that really speaks to some of that settler mentality we have here, that unresolved history we have about our relationship to the original inhabitants of Australia, kind of uneasy place we have here as the people that came later post-colonisation. So it's all in this mix when it comes to pseudo-law.
I do find myself in court on occasion, and it seems like it's not unusual to see pseudo-law arguments getting run much more often these days. Has there been a big increase in pseudo-law adherence in Australia?
It certainly feels like it. Like in the book, we look at this, the gauntlet that a lot of council workers, a lot of low-level courts have to run now with these pseudo-law claims being thrown at them daily. Like the New South Wales Judiciary Handbook has had to be updated to include more information about how to deal with pseudo-law litigants. There's certainly like a lot of gurus out there shilling courses held over Zoom, $200 a month to get out of parking fines and the like. And I spoke to one woman who's actually tried these arguments in an Australian courtroom. Suffice it to say, they haven't worked. But when you actually start talking to people that are trying to use these arguments, often can be a pretty sad story. It's someone that has fallen through the cracks in some way, who has found themselves confronting like the impenetrable edifice of a bank or the legal system, and has turned to these ideas in a desperation. So it's a really complex picture, but it certainly seems like it's ticking up, and Australian courts are definitely struggling to deal with it.
Another claim that you examine in the book is popularly referred to as the Great Replacement, and there have been various, I guess, ideologues promoting it, but came to a rather bloody fruition in Christchurch in 2019. Can you guys tell us about what you found when you looked at those sorts of claims?
Yeah, this is probably one of the most confronting parts of reporting out the book, like taking a closer look at this idea of the Great Replacement. So basically the idea that there is some plot to undermine the white race or to eradicate it from certain Western nations. And the people behind the plot, it can be a whole cast of figures. Often it's Jewish people that are behind the so-called plot to eradicate the white race. And we find it appearing in different forms in Europe, in the United States. But when you look back like at the rhetoric in Australia of the past decade, we see those narratives flowing here through our media and our politics in all kinds of places. This idea that there is an invasion from the outside, whether it be the scapegoat of the day. In the 70s and 80s, perhaps it was Asian immigrants, then it became Muslim immigrant with a distinct strain of Islamophobia. This really runs through Australian culture and our unease as a outpost of the West in Asia, I feel. Like, Andy, I talked to you for this chapter, actually, because you have all this history at your fingertips. I wonder how you see it playing out now, too.
That thesis now in 2025?
Mm.
Well, I think like a lot of the material you examine, the precise claims, they may be slightly augmented or adapted according to the circumstance, but that notion of a society in crisis that is at risk of implosion because of foreign elements of one sort or another seems to underpin a lot of politics and remain a constant factor. I think when it's picked up and given a very, let's say, radical or extremist interpretation, that's when I guess those are the situations or contexts in which these sorts of atrocities are more likely to appear. So I see it as a kind, as you said, like a long-running tension that can be appealed to by various political actors at various stages when it suits them. So it remains a constant threat. The thing that I found, and it's documented elsewhere in the book, is the way in which those kinds of claims circulate through the body politic and become normalised. And so I'm not really sure what the current state of play is, but it does appeal, it seems, to a whole range of more free-floating anxieties that are then crystallised in this form. So it remains, in a sense, a latent threat as far as I can tell, and something that will be recurringly popular, especially to various sectors on the right.
Yeah, exactly. We really wanted to make that point in the book that we see conspiratorial narratives, frameworks being used by politicians in Australia, by the media. So that's something we wanted to confront in the book too. And in the Christchurch context, really that failure of Australia to take a good look at itself in the wake of the Christchurch massacre, to own the terrorist as an Australian person that grew up marinated in Australian culture, and really look at that more closely.
And the thing that really came out of the book as well was thinking about how in Australia, how often conspiracy theories are actually used and to reverse a power imbalance, but to make the vulnerable people into this great evil who can be hated. Like that's an example of the Great Replacement, changing it from, you know, the fact that in Australia, like multicultural, like we're a multicultural nation, but like obviously people of color face a lot of racism, but by flipping this on its head, rather than being like, how are we treating people who are in some ways discriminated against, we turn this into this plot that in some ways that, you know, that this nation is being taken over by these people, and that allows, that gives a lot of people that permission structure to then feel like this is something that they should be fighting against, rather than perhaps interrogating maybe why they feel this way towards people who look different to them.
Just last weekend in Melbourne, we saw an anti-Islam rally that was held on the back of a much conspiracy theorizing. There was a recent march, a religious procession of Muslims within Melbourne. At one point, they happened to walk past a church, and this was characterized by the far right, and I guess just on the right, as being this great act of Islamist intimidation. It was just people walking in the street. That's all culminated on Sunday with this protest, where at one point, after the Christian nationalist leader of the protest and Avi Yemeni kicked out a black neo-Nazi from the rally, they got into a massive argument with white neo-Nazis about it, which I thought was, you know, talk about the great replacement. Not even the neo-Nazis are safe from being replaced. Could you speak a little bit about how we see Islamophobia being, I guess, employed within these conspiracy theories?
Well, when you're looking back through the Australian conversation around immigration from countries that have Muslim population, different countries in the Middle East and other places, we see these narrative threads recur again and again, this framework of an invasion, which I would argue, and others have too, the word invasion implies the need for a really strong, even a military or a violent response. So this is the kind of language you can see all through Australian media. And I'm not, I saw the clips and things about this march you're referring to, Cam, too, and it reminded me too, just what a global, what's the conveyor belt of conspiracy meme there is now, because that didn't just travel around Australia. I saw international far-right influencers taking that footage and putting their own captions on it, interpreting it in the way you've described. It really circumnavigated the world and came back to Australia ready to fit within our own particular forms of Islamophobia. So yeah, it's some global picture at this point.
What Ariel's saying is that they're actually the real globalists. I think when we talk about this, and particularly when you guys talk about this, Cam and Andy, who are such experts on it, and try to work through it, there's a coherency in the way that you talk about them that almost lends it a credence. But you were talking about these people who sometimes have sometimes contradictory aims, or sometimes they are fighting but actually want the same thing, a white ethnostate or whatever. And I think it's kind of important to say that conspiracy theories have this incredible ability to bring all these people together, because ultimately it's about this grievance against an often poorly or undefined other and evil that allows people with all kinds of different views in the world to somehow be brought together. And that's why, in some cases, that's why these movements are hamstrung by the fact that, if you scratch a little bit deeper, there's not actually that much bonding them together. But the flip side is that's how they're so able to bring all these people together, because really, at the end of the day, it's quite simple. It's I understand the world in a way, I'm good and someone else is evil, and we're calling out that evil.
Cam and Ariel, in the book, there's many actors who are acting on the basis that they care for the welfare of children and want to protect them from all these evil forces. I was wondering if you could say a little bit more about how children, or the idea of children, are deployed in these kinds of worldviews, and why you think that's the case. Why have children especially emerged as a key mobilising force?
Yeah, well, there's long historical roots here, right? The idea that there is a plot against children, or there is some group out there with evil designs on our children, is a long-running one. We can think back to blood libel of medieval Europe against Jewish people. There are plenty of examples of this. But I guess for me personally, it started bubbling up through those pandemic years, and even into some of the protests I've been covering, you might put under the anti-renewable energy bucket or the anti-referendum bucket too, which is bizarre to say. Every time I went to one of these protests, no matter what the topic was, there would be signs, T-shirts, posters about the 28. And I had a loose idea of what that was, but we took a closer look at this in the book. So back in 2015, Senator Bill Heffernan brought a list to Senate estimates, what he claimed was a list of 28 prominent pedophiles that he had been given. No one knew really where the list had come from, who was on it, whether it had been signed, witnessed, nothing. And although nothing more really came of it, because it was just a list of people at the end of the day, it's become a central narrative, kind of like Port Arthur of Australian conspiracy theory culture, people insisting that the list is legitimate, or perhaps falsely claiming that there's a suppression order on the list that shan't be listed for 90 years. I think it's is our, I wouldn't say our version of QAnon, but it fit very well. It like immediately lent itself to those QAnon era narratives, really based around the idea that children were under threat and that there was evil forces at work aiming to exploit, torture, harvest adrenochrome, all that stuff from the children. And I think, you know, at the end of the day, that it's a very convenient narrative framework. Again, like as journalist Anna Merlin pointed out, as soon as you say somebody has evil designs against children, they become the ultimate enemy. It's a very quick shorthand to train enemy. So I think that's really often the narrative reason why it's deployed.
A little less grim than harvesting adrenochrome from children is harvesting activated almonds. What a segue. Cam, could tell us a little bit about what it was like going along to Pete Evans's retreat?
Yeah, it was pretty crazy, honestly. So people would probably remember Pete Evans was an enormous Australian media personality throughout the 2010s until it all came off the road in 2020 during the height of the pandemic when he started. He went from he was always alluded towards his anti-vaccine and other pseudoscience beliefs, but he transitioned very publicly into full-blown conspiracy beliefs, posting graphics about satanic child abuse by elites and that kind of thing. And so after that, he left the public eye. He was kicked off his, or I guess he parted ways with My Kitchen Rules, and he lost a lot of his sponsorships, and he mostly disappeared. What many people might not know is that he started running his own retreat hidden away just outside of Byron Bay in the Northern Rivers, where he promised to, essentially teach people about his beliefs and for anyone who would stump up a couple thousand dollars. We thought that he was such an important public figure that we wanted to know what was happening at these retreats, particularly considering that many of the people who ended up at these retreats likely started being like one of his fans on when they watched Channel 7 and went down this funnel. We wanted to see where that led. So I went undercover at a Pete Evans retreat with him and a handful of other people. And I went with a fake name and I changed my occupation. But other than that, I just said, I'm going to be myself and just observe what's going on and act normally. And so I spent 2 days at a retreat with Pete and a few other people who were all very much big believers in conspiracy theories. And during that time, I got an understanding for him, which was that Evans had resigned himself to the understanding that he didn't have that mainstream reach anymore. And he'd always, as I did some research into him way down the chapter, he'd always been someone who had very pragmatically looked at his character on TV as a way of reaching people with his views of the world and subtly pushing them towards his beliefs. At the retreat, he was very upfront about the things that he believed in terms of being anti-vaccine, believing in some pretty wild stuff, honestly, but also understand, you know, his view of the world had changed. You know, he knew he was no longer someone who was preaching to the masses, but he believed that with the people who were coming to this retreat to learn from him, he viewed his influence as, now I get to know these people, I teach them about my way of the world, and then they go out into the world and they further on my message from there.
Pete might be pragmatic, but, you know, the Australian media can sometimes be very forgiving of people's trespasses. Do you think he could ever make a return to the main stage?
I mean, this is the crazy thing, because I'm so attuned to this, I pick it up all the time. You know, he has been getting a bit of a welcome back into parts of the Australian media. He did do, after he was, you know, persona non grata, and I should add the reason why, like the straw too far was when he shared a pretty explicitly like a comic with pretty explicit neo-Nazi imagery. He said that he didn't understand like what the implication of a comic was, but I think there's reasons to, I mean, at one point he contradicts himself, but regardless of whatever you kind of say, you know, he welcomed himself into the MAGA movement. He's very pro-Trump now, and now this isn't news, but like at the time he was telling me, before RFK had even run for president, that he was in constant contact with him and that he had these big plans. But yeah, so all that to say is like he'd finally done enough that he'd reached the level that Australian media and mainstream institutions had decided, well, like, we can't really countenance this anymore. But he has been getting invited back. Like he's appeared on 2GB. He's appeared on Kiss FM with Kyle and Jackie O. He's done these little appearances here and there that I think show that I think it's mostly that the world has changed and that we're the whole, you know, Overton window of politics has moved a little bit that way. I think it's clear that the door is not completely shut to him. I don't think he's going to be on ABC tomorrow, but there are now very major parts of Australian media who will invite him on and not apologize for it.
I mean, if look at a pigeon murderer turned Hooters spokesperson, Nick Adams, who's now the ambassador for Malaysia. I mean, the sky's the limit, really.
Yeah, it's aspirational in a way, isn't it?
Like maybe getting back into the Australian media, aiming a little low.
Speaking of Australian media, guys, during lockdown and response to COVID, but other things as well, a number of media organisations employed fact checkers to look at the claims that were circulating online and attempt to bring some light to them. More recently, a number of fact checkers seem to have lost their jobs, partly as a result of the change in US president. What do you think is the media's responsibilities in this area? Do you think things like having fact checking teams is a useful thing to have? And how do you think people working in media can better understand and respond to the kinds of dubious claims that underpin a lot of conspiracy theories?
We've seen a global backlash against this idea of fact-checking, against serious studies and attempts at an institutional level to counteract misinformation or conspiracy theories. And even on the tech platforms where a lot of us now find out about the world, a pushback against, at least publicly, content moderation, so citing that some kinds of speech are and aren't acceptable. And I think that you also just generally see that in the media as well. I think that it's like there's a whole nuanced discussion specifically about like fact checking and content moderation. But in terms of like the media, I mean, the big thing that I learned from the Pete Evans chapter when I was looking back with the context of what he became was that like the signs were always there from very, very early on. He was not so subtly hinting towards being anti-vaccine or anti-fluoride and all this stuff. And despite, you know, these mainstream media companies, particularly Seven, who he was, you know, who hosted his show, and for them, he was this, the golden goose because he, or is it the goose that wears the golden? Anyway, he was one of their key figures in the media. He was making them so much money that they didn't want to rock the boat on that. And so they were happy to promote him. And there is a like counterfactual in a world where particularly I think around 2015, it seemed like Evan started getting more and more comfortable about sharing some of these pseudoscience beliefs that Seven, and there started to be a couple of controversies that happened. Seven could have done something about it then, we don't know what they did privately, but they didn't have to keep him as like essentially one of the faces of the network. They could have said, this guy who's antagonizing the Australian Medical Association, who's promoting crank doctors, maybe he shouldn't be the face of, you know, this family cooking show. Like, what does that do? Now, obviously they didn't do that. But the big lesson for me is like, when we talk about conspiracy theories, we spend a lot of time thinking about the people in the true fringes. But to me, someone like Evans is incredibly influential because he's this massive figure. You know, he was like one of the best people known in Australia. He was the best-selling author for years and years with his cookbooks. And for him at the same time to be saying, don't trust doctors, don't trust medicine, you know, trust me, and saying that if you do the paleo diet, you know, your eyes will become wider and all your problems will be fixed. Like, that is actually that kernel of thinking that leads you down the road to ultimately not trusting mainstream institutions and ending up doing what he's done. So for me, I think the big thing is like, yes, like of course journalists should always be trying to tell the truth and should be thinking critically and trying to be balanced, because I also think that a big part is making sure that you reflect a variety of views so that people don't feel like the media doesn't necessarily represent them. But at the same time, the big decisions need to be made by these often corporate media owners who decide who are the people who are getting all the attention, which then dictates what are the ideas that are allowed to exist in Australian society, mainstream discourse, and what doesn't. And I think that we should be more on guard for accepting that, like, maybe someone makes you a lot of money, it doesn't necessarily mean that that's good for you, but there is a cost for the rest of Australian society.
In the book, there's also, you examine people who are attempting to fight back, and thinking in particular of someone who's specialized in attempting to debunk pseudo-law, having fallen victim to those sorts of doctrines himself previously. Do you see much evidence of that thing going on in terms of tackling this nation beset by conspiracies?
So we wanted to include some idea of how people are pushing back against the worst excesses of these ideas, because I didn't want to leave people at absolute bottom of the barrel depression after reading our book by any means. But we found the most kind of positive moves towards this kind of emerging on the really personal level or the community level. So you're referring there to Robert Sudi, who's a really interesting character. I mean, he had at one point been into these pseudo-law ideas himself. So back a couple of decades ago, he had some traffic fine car issues, appeared before a court, and then attempted to use some of these pseudo-law claims. It didn't work, but he in that moment had an interaction with a magistrate, David Halpern, who I spoke to as well for the book. And that set him, or at least helped put his feet on the road towards pushing back against these ideas. He started doing more research, but finding a way out of these pseudo-law ideas, and now maintains this website, Freeman Delusion, which is a really complete accounting of all the pseudo-law claims and history and cases here in Australia. We also looked a bit at the community-led approach to pushing back against the anti-drag story time protests that we saw heat up a couple of years ago. This was there was that broad claim again around children that these drag queen story hours were sites of grooming that would turn every Australian youth into a trans man or woman. Of course, it was complete nonsense, but there started to be a steady drumbeat of protests at these events. In some cases, far-right groups like Active 88 showing up in Wollongong and other instances like that. And then there was a community-led pushback. We spoke to people outside a protest in Thirroul, in Illawarra, outside Sydney, who had all shown up to make sure that the drag queen story hour went out off without a hitch, said that that protection couldn't really come from police, couldn't really come from the state. It really had to come from that community level, because you couldn't quite trust the state or police or law enforcement to maybe take the stand that the community wanted. So it's a complex mix there, because we also want to acknowledge too that the highly personal effects that it can have here. And no one we spoke to said that there's some magic switch, some magic sentence to utter to somebody who's fallen into the rabbit hole, as it were, and to bring them back out. But there's a lot of community level things we do to make sure people aren't harmed by these ideas.
Well, Ariel, Cam, we'll have to leave it there. The book is Conspiracy Nation. It is out through Ultimo Press. People can, of course, find you on Blue Sky and your reporting in The Guardian and on Cricky.com. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
So good to be with you guys. Thank you.
Well, Andy, that is our program. We will be back next week.
Yep, we'll see you then. Bye.
Questions, questions, questions flooding into the mind of the concerned young person today.
It's nearly Science Week again, so you better be getting your teams ready for the annual Lost in Science Trivia for 2025.
Yes, Monday the 11th of August, starting at 6 at the Birmingham Hotel in Fitzroy, Melbourne.
All the details on the 3CR website or on the Lost in Science Facebook page.
And if you want to register for a table, email us at lostinsci@gmail.com.
What's taking place in Palestine is horrendous.
Here are some ways that you can keep yourself informed and involved.
Listen in to Palestine Remembered every Saturday morning at 9:30 a.m. or listen to the podcast.
Join the APAN mailing list at apan.org.au for updates, news about actions you can get involved in, and where you can donate to provide humanitarian assistance.
Listen to other news and current affairs programs on 3CR that also cover Palestine.
The oppression of the Palestinian people has been going on for 75 years. It has to stop. You can be part of making that happen by staying informed and active.
APAN is a proud supporter of 3CR.